Hi, everybody. It's Richard Zwicky at the Green Peak. And joining us today, we have Dustin Robinson, who is the managing principal of Eider Investments, a firm focused on investing in the psychedelic space, for want of a better and simpler definition. Welcome aboard, Dustin.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
So you're incredibly active in the psychedelic space, as well as having a good background in the cannabis space. But you are a lawyer by background. You've evolved through the business. Tell us a bit how you came to run Eider and what brought you along the way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually started off several years ago, got involved in the cannabis space just with some friends that needed help putting together a transaction. Didn't have any sort of formal law firm at the time. I had just exited a manufacturing business that I was running. So it was kind of taking a year off and helped those friends with the transaction. Before I knew it, I was getting a lot of requests to help with complex commercial transactions within the cannabis space, and noticed that there really weren't any big law firms at the time getting involved. Now, all those big law firms are starting to get more involved in cannabis. At the time, they weren't. So found that there was really a void in the market for attorneys that could do complex commercial transactions within the cannabis space. So started my law firm several years ago, and ran it, for a few years just in Florida, but we've expanded. Now we're in Florida, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Michigan, California. We have like three more states we're opening up in the next couple months. So very active.
How many lawyers?
We have about five lawyers.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, but it was really about 4 years ago, we represent a lot of doctors at my law firm. And about 4 years ago, they started reaching out about getting involved in psychedelics. And I was quite surprised at the time. I had actually never tried a psychedelic.
Right.
I would kind of carried the stigma with me. So I was kind of surprised I was getting phone calls. But after I got like the third call, I asked these doctors to share some of the research. So geeked out on the research for a few months, the research out of Imperial College, Johns Hopkins, NYU, Yale. A lot of these very highly esteemed institutions were coming out with some really tremendous research. So I was blown away by what I was reading and really surprised. So decided to help these doctors launch some businesses, some research programs. We launched some ketamine telehealth companies, ketamine clinics, research collaborations with universities. Started then investing in the space. And in that time period, I also had my first psychedelic experience, which really kind of validated a lot of the research I was reading. I was quite surprised. I grew up my whole life kind of believing that these compounds turn your brain into mush. And then I read all this research showing how they alter consciousness and could actually help your brain. And then doing it myself and experiencing myself was quite transformational. So I started a nonprofit actually in 2019 focused on legal reform. It's called Mr. Psychedelic Law. Uh-huh. We've been very involved in a lot of the bills at a state and city level. We actually filed a bill in Florida. I think it was 2020. We filed a bill in Florida. It didn't pass, but it got the conversation started.
Right.
But then investing my own capital, started syndicating deals. I met my partner at my investment fund about 3 years ago. And that's when we decided to formalize it into a fund. And we went out, we raised capital. We have a little under $30 million under management. We've invested in about 18 companies. And it's really broader than psychedelics. It's really focused on mental and behavioral health. But we do have a very strong conviction around psychedelic medicine. So I would say about 70 to 80% of our portfolio is related to psychedelic medicines.
Right. Okay. And that makes perfect sense to tie it into mental health as well, because so many of the psychedelics are used as treatment protocols for mental health related issues. And I know I'm building a platform in the technology space around it. And the meeting points for treatment and long-term progress across the various therapeutic practices, there's no way to separate one from the other. When you're addressing some of the challenges from a legal aspect, it's much simpler in psychedelics than it is in cannabis. How is it different for you as the lawyer handling the transactions than it would be from when you were dealing with them in cannabis?
Yeah, I mean, cannabis really developed mainly through these state authorized programs, which, kind of went counter to federal law. Right. We have the supremacy clause in our U.S. Constitution that says federal law is supreme to state law. So even though some of these state authorized businesses or state authorized programs were allowing cannabis, it's still federally legal. So you had all sorts of complications from insurance, banking, real estate, M&A, a lot of different complications in the cannabis industry. Psychedelic industry, in contrast, mainly started to progress through the normal federal pathway, which is FDA clinical trials. And so most of the company, actually all the companies we've invested in are actually operating legally from a federal perspective, whatever jurisdiction they're in. We've invested in the UK, we've invested in Canada, we've invested in a lot of different countries as well. Right. But our investment fund only invests in companies that are operating fully legally. So that certainly makes it a little bit more simple from a legal perspective, although FDA regulations are quite complicated, especially when you're dealing with a Schedule I controlled substance. But you know, then you also have, you know, outside my investment fund, my law firm also represents a lot of psychedelic companies. And you do have state authorized programs in the psychedelic space, like we're seeing in Oregon and Colorado. And those states are going to have some of the same complications as cannabis does. You also have kind of a big push on the religious side. We're seeing a lot of psychedelic churches open up, which is another big complicated area of law. You also have psychedelics big in the
end of life. Actually, we had a guest on a while ago who was talking about creating an ayahuasca church. And those are interesting as how the people can create churches in the U.S. for a purpose. Can you walk us through how you see that?
Yeah, it's quite complicated. It's probably, I would say, the religious side of the psychedelic industry is probably even more complicated than the cannabis stuff that we deal with. You know, we have there's a federal law called RFRA, that's an abbreviation, but it basically, you know, protects religious freedoms, allows you to practice your religion. And obviously throughout our constitution, we have the protections of religions. And what happened though, is that the DEA came out with guidelines that essentially say that these religious, entities need to apply to them if they're handling any controlled substances. And so obviously psychedelics are controlled, but in those DEA guidelines, it requires that you show that this is basically a key, that the sacrament, the medicine, is actually a key to practicing your faith. But it also requires that during the review process that you do not use that medicine. So it's almost like by its guidelines, it essentially tells you, You have to show us that it's central to practicing your religion. But during this review period, which, by the way, could take 2, 5, 10 years, the DEA is not exactly in a rush to review these. During that review period, you can't actually practice your faith by using this medicine. You know, you have to show it's a sincere belief and a part of your religion. So that is being challenged in court. And so what a lot of these, I would say 90% of the religious churches that you see are kind of ignoring those DEA guidelines and going through the normal process of filing for a church. And really that's just through the IRS that you just file as a church and you practice as a church. So certainly that could be challenged. It is definitely a very gray area of the law. And so, you know, when we work with those clients, obviously we have to be very clear that this is very gray. It's not black and white. And there's certainly some risk there.
And, you know, you see a timeline of the FDA doing approvals by middle of next year and the DEA by the end of next year. How does that change the marketplace and where does it impact most first? Because, like you said, it's going to be federal, but which states do you see really picking it up and running with it most aggressively?
Yeah, so the program that's closest to the end is MAPS's MDMA for PTSD trial. We're investors in MAPS, so we're very close to that. They just submitted their NDA earlier this month. We're expecting approval probably around August 2024. That'll be approval by the DEA, approval by the FDA. Then the DEA will have to reschedule within 90 days. So hopefully we'll have FDA approval and DEA rescheduling by the end of 2024. But what a lot of people don't realize is there's over 20 states that don't automatically adopt the DEA scheduling program, such as the state I'm in here in Florida. And so those states will actually have to affirmatively change their state level scheduling to make MDMA available through prescription. Just to be clear, when it gets rescheduled by the DEA, it'll likely end up on Schedule 3. And most likely it'll be a bifurcated scheduling, meaning that they're not going to just reschedule MDMA period. It'll be MAPS's specific MDMA formulation. So most likely MDMA will stay a Schedule 1. There will just be a carve out for MAPS, MAPS's MDMA, which will be Schedule 3. And those states, the over 20 states, will have to also affirmatively take action to reschedule. We hope to see patients probably, you know, first patients being dosed with MDMA probably first quarter of 2025. But it's going to take some time to really reach scale. Probably end of 2025, early 2026 is when we hope it'll start really reaching commercial scale. And then after that, we have several programs behind that. Compass Pathways, the furthest along on psilocybin. They're doing USONA. Is doing psilocybin for MDD, major depressive disorder. TRD is treatment-resistant depression. And then you have various programs after that. Some of our portfolio companies are studying 5-MeO, DMT, ibogaine, DMT, mescaline. A variety of other compounds are coming in behind it. So MDMA is going to definitely knock down the barriers, and we're doing everything we can to support MAPS in commercializing it.
That's excellent. We do have to take a short break, but we'll be back in a moment with Dustin Robinson on the Green Peak. And we're back on the Green Peak with Dustin Robinson from Eider Investments. And Dustin, just before the break, you were talking about some of the research that's being done. And it's interesting, we had Dr. Ingmar Gorman out of Oregon on a little while ago, and he's running one of the CDC studies into MDMA for PTSD, and I think specifically for veterans, if I remember correctly. You mentioned as being probably one of the fastest paths as far as what's going to be approved for the marketplace. What do you see as being the game-changing effect of MDMA being approved, and how does it open the door for the next ones? From a legal perspective and for the through the regulatory framework?
Yeah, so the big change in getting MDMA approved is that it's getting approved alongside what's called REMS, Risk Evaluation Mitigation Strategy, where they are requiring it's used in conjunction with psychotherapy. So this will be the first compound approved in conjunction with therapy with it. So it's really never been seen before. So, you know, we don't really know how these REMS are going to work out. And a lot of investors and others are skeptical on the commercialization viability of pairing the compound with psychedelic therapy. Obviously, there's additional costs there. There's certain infrastructure required. The current paradigm is you go to a pharmacy, you get your SSRI or your benzo, you go home and you take it probably for the rest of your life, right? So this is a total paradigm shift where you have to go into a clinic and have it administered at the clinic. So I think really proving out the commercialization model is going to be the biggest key for MAPS. You know, the approval seems like it is inevitable. Obviously, we don't want to do a touchdown dance before we're in the end zone, but their phase 3 trials are absolutely tremendous with over 86%. Responding positively from MDMA psychedelic assisted therapy, and then over 70% of their participants no longer being clinically diagnosed with PTSD after going through their MDMA psychedelic assisted therapy. So the research is absolutely tremendous. It's showing these compounds work. I think the big question now is the commercialization potential with this therapy. So, you know, I mentioned Compass with psilocybin. They're doing something very similar where it's paired with psychedelic therapy. There are now some psychedelic companies that are actually trying to take out the requirement for therapy. So there's a big kind of philosophical debate, you know, on these compounds. These compounds could be helpful without therapy. The therapy obviously makes them even more
helpful. Sure, because they help people unlock the doors and access the memories that otherwise they're blocked from, where they, you know, their own fears and challenges are blocking them. And the therapy opens that up. It's dangerous to explore some of those without a safety net. And so, you know, I think it's really wise for people to do at least to start in conjunction with therapy, because it's
I think
no guardrails.
You know, my opinion is exactly the same as yours. Like, you know, something as revolutionary as this and as powerful as these compounds, I think it's important in the beginning to put up as much guardrails as possible And slowly you could start peel them down. But the two competing interests right now are access. And in order to get access, you need to make it as affordable as possible versus safety. To be as safe as possible, you want a lot of guardrails. But, you know, if you put up too many guardrails, it's not that accessible. So, you know, those are, and you see Oregon and Colorado kind of struggling with these two competing interests of accessibility versus safety. And I think it's very, very important that Oregon and Colorado be very, very careful about not overemphasizing the access part without also taking deep consideration into the safety side of it.
Yeah, because, you know, when you think about it, yes, it can be legally accessed, let's say, through the marketplace if there aren't the proper guardrails in place. But if a firm sells it to the consumer who then inflicts damage on themselves, the firm would actually be open to some liability, because even though it may have complied with the letter, it knew better.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we're talking about having like civil liability conversations, it really depends under what legal framework you're operating in. Under the sure. MDMA, FDA, clinical trial, pharmaceutical,
that's labeled, different. Yeah.
Yeah, being approved under a very specific protocol. But even in Oregon, their framework requires that it's done at a service center and needs to be with a licensed facilitator, right? So, you know, at the end of the day, you need to follow those. If you follow those protocols, you know, there's actually very low safety risk. These compounds are actually extremely safe. When done in the right container, they're actually extremely safe. But if a service center out in Oregon all of a sudden sold psilocybin to someone, went against the rules, didn't require them to be at the service center with a licensed facilitator, something bad happened, obviously there's quite a bit of civil liability there.
Yeah, and I'm not as concerned for people as much for people who dose improperly, although that's always challenging. It's more for as people access memories which they don't recognize are going to be accessed in the course of a program. That can be that can be shattering for some people's personas.
Yeah, and that's why we've worked a lot on informed consents, even with ketamine. Right now, ketamine is a approved pharmaceutical. It's being used off label. So those consent forms are very important for doctors to be using. And even the service centers in Oregon are required to provide certain disclosures to the patients. So the patients, or in Oregon, I guess they're not considered patients necessarily, consumers. You know, they need to make sure they read those informed consent forms, because you're absolutely right. These compounds could open up new memories. They really allow you to go really deep. And if you don't have the proper support and you're not prepared for it, potentially it could take you in a backwards direction rather than moving forward.
Yeah. And I mean, it's tremendous what they can do and how we can open the doors for so many people with them. I'm a strong advocate. I'm also, because like you, have some interest and activity in the mental health arena as well. I recognize, you know, it's incredibly powerful as an assistive tool, but a lot of those journeys, you don't want to be gone alone.
Yeah.
Now, when you do look at that and you look at the guardrails and you look at the frameworks that are being put in place, as an investment firm, how does that enter into your criteria?
Yeah, well, we've developed different theses around different compounds and different indications. So we have certain compounds we think will be effective for certain indications, other compounds that we think will be effective for other indications. Another big area right now that we've been looking into is these psychoplastogens is what they're calling them, but essentially they're non-hallucinogenic psychedelics. Now, it's kind of weird to call them psychedelics, but they're psychedelic inspired. They right. hit all the serotonin receptors, but they don't hit that 5-HT2A receptor that's responsible for the hallucinations. And there's been some really interesting data out there whether or not we really need this subjective experience. We believe, through talking to we have a whole team of doctors and scientists who are venture partners with our firm. We believe that some of these non-hallucinogenic psychedelics, we think they could be effective for some of these neurodegenerative diseases, but I don't believe that will be very effective for things like PTSD, depression, things where you really need your brain kind of rattled up. I think you really need that subjective experience, that hallucinatory experience for those conditions. But we do think for certain indications, they could be very beneficial. But right now, you know, the guardrails are being put up, all the hallucinogenic stuff at an FDA level, for the most part, they're putting up quite a bit of guardrails to make sure it's done in a safe manner.
Right. No, I appreciate that. And I, you know, I think it's tremendous. What I'm more asking now is, you know, as a firm, let's say, that was going to come and approach you with regards to investment, how do you look at how they're addressing these issues in terms of a part of the decision process, whether to move forward or not with them? What do you look for and not look for?
Yeah, well, we do deep diligence on, you know, when you're doing FDA clinical trials, you have a whole, your clinical trial design is very important. How many therapists? What's the protocol? You know, are we offering preparation? Are we offering integration? How many, for example, in MAPS, there's three administration sessions over a 12-week period. They have a preparation session before each one and three integration sessions after each administration session. So that study design was very, very specific. So our team, our doctors, our scientists, we'll look at that clinical trial design to try to assess and look at previous research. A lot of the universities have done some relatively small studies. We've yet to invest in any of the companies that are trying to just strip out the therapy aspect of it, except for we invested in Solera, which is doing what I was describing before, the non-hallucinogenic psychedelics. The interesting thing about the therapy side is that therapy is beneficial for anyone with or without drugs. Right? SSRI, people should be doing therapy in conjunction. So it's no surprise that these compounds are more effective when used in conjunction with therapy. Well, it's also interesting that MAPS, one of their arms of their study, just did MDMA. So obviously, they had their placebo group that didn't receive MDMA.
Yeah.
They had their, that received MDMA with therapy, but they also had a group that just received MDMA with no therapy. And that group actually had significant improvement as well. So that really begs the question, you know, is there a way to make this more accessible by not requiring the therapy, not putting it on the label, still recommending it? I recommend it for anyone taking a compound or not taking a compound.
Right.
Even if you think you're healthy, mental health therapy is a good thing usually. So, you know, we haven't invested in any companies that are trying to strip out entirely that therapy. And I think we got to, these companies need to be very careful about doing that. But I do understand the basis for what they're trying to achieve there.
Yeah, and that's excellent. Dustin, we do have to take one more short break, but we'll be back in a moment on The Green Peak with Dustin Robinson. I'm Richard Zwicky. And we're back on The Green Peak with Dustin Robinson of Eider Investments. And Dustin, earlier on you mentioned that Eider has raised or has about $30 million under management and invested in 18 portfolio companies. Raising a fund isn't trivial at the best of times, but raising a fund for a marketplace like psychedelics, which is developing and so has its own hairy elements, which have yet to be discovered, is a little more challenging than some. How have you found that market? Are the investors looking at it like they did in cannabis in 2014-15, where they could see the green pastures, or are they a little more skeptical or a little more open because it is going through the FDA and DEA process?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things. Number one, I think, you know, the psychedelic industry does definitely opens you up to a whole different set of investors, because a lot of investors, especially some of these big family offices or institutional funds, they really couldn't invest in what they call sin industries, things that are illegal like cannabis. What we're investing in is all legal stuff. So it did open up kind of a whole different kind of door of investors. But there are a lot of our investors did come from the cannabis industry. They understand these alternative type therapies, and we're very interested in it. But I think what's important is to understand that there's been kind of an evolution in the investor interest in the psychedelic industry. In 2019, 2020, there was tremendous interest and a tremendous amount of capital coming into the industry. In 2021, 2022, 2022 is when we started to see a drop off. And then in 2023, we saw an even bigger drop off. So, you know, unfortunately, you know, there was a lot of people really excited. Some got caught up in the hype in 2019, 2020, even into 2021. And now that hype has kind of died off. You're seeing valuations come way down from their peaks. And it's challenging. Right now, currently, it's very challenging. The industry, with the macroeconomic situation, everything's at a discount. You know, these non-risky deals, most investors right now are risk off because you have these high interest rate. You get a treasury bond at 6% right now. You could buy highly mature companies and established industries at deep discounts. Right. So a lot of big family offices, institutional investors are not looking at risk on investments. And psychedelics is certainly an emerging category and a risk on type of investment. So, and that's really a macroeconomic situation. I tell people research is objective to market. So the research has continued to be very, very positive. But unfortunately, due to the macroeconomic conditions, we've seen a significant decrease in capital coming into the industry.
Yeah, and I know that's been a huge challenge in the cannabis industry, and but psychedelics is being future forward looking. It's along with AI and a few other things really looks to be where the money should go for as far as gains.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, when you make money when the times are tough, I mean, right, values are down. And if you believe in this medicine, if you believe in the safety, you believe in the efficacy of these compounds, right now is actually an unbelievable time, in my opinion, to get involved in the industry. You could get in at very, very low valuations. And I think the potential for the industry is tremendous. But that being said, there's also a lot of risks. I think, you know, out of the, I would say there's probably like 200 or so legitimate psychedelic companies right now. Out of those, you know, there might only be 15 to 20 survivors, right? Mm-hmm. So although valuations are down, it's also relatively complicated to pick the right winners. And that's why we decided to make a fund where we could diligence these companies. Even with my background as an attorney, as a CPA, as an investor, I wouldn't be able to diligence and pick the winners on my own. And that's why I really needed to kind of formalize it into a fund and bring a team in that's able to diligence it. So I do think there's a really good opportunity to get in the right companies at low valuations. But I also caution people that it's a very complicated industry to invest in due to, you know, patents are a big thing. And there's a lot of blind spots with patents because they don't actually publish for 18 months after filing. So you could invest in a company that has a great team, great concept, they look good, but if they don't have any moat, they have no patent there, you know, it's kind of a road to nowhere. So a very complicated industry to invest in. I think it lends itself to specialized funds such as Eater.
Yeah, and Eater is looking to launch a second fund, so a fund two. How much would you be targeting?
We'll probably be targeting a little over $100 million. We think it'll be a different type of strategy, different type of thesis. We'll still be very involved in mental and behavioral health. We'll still have high conviction investments into psychedelics. But we'll likely start to look at companies that are a little bit more later stage. Our first fund was really, very focused on like seed series A rounds. I think we'll start to look more at like the series A, series B, and even potentially, doing some block trading on some of the publicly traded companies. So yeah, we're ironing out our entire thesis right now and hope to launch that sometime in the first quarter of 2024.
Oh, fantastic. People who want to learn more about you and the company, where should they visit?
Eaterinvestments.com, I-T-E-R investments.com. That's our website. See our portfolio companies, our team. You could also check out MrPsychedelicLaw.com. That's my nonprofit. We also have a venture studio where we launch various media assets. So for example, we own a website called PsychedelicInvest.com that basically provides all sorts of investment data for people interested in investing in the space. So definitely recommend checking out PsychedelicInvest.com. We also own another website called newly.com. That's NEULY.com. It's basically the largest database of information around the psychedelic space. So we keep track of every patent, every clinical trial, every company, every person, every investor. We basically take all that data, every research article, we take all that data and we try to make sense of it so that people who are interested in the industry, if they're trying to find courses or podcasts or whatever it might be, Newly is an incredibly robust resource for that.
So Dustin, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Green Peak today, and I'd like to invite you back in a few months as the process moves through the various phases of FDA and DEA approval to review the progress and look at what's coming next. But it's been a great conversation.
Absolutely. Appreciate being here and happy to come on whenever you'd like to have me.
Fantastic. And thanks to everybody for listening. We'll be back again with you soon. I'm Richard Zwicky.